You're listening to the podcast of Williamsburg Christian Church, a community of faith joining God's pursuit of restoring lives. We hope you enjoy this week's podcast. In the Christian tradition, vices are more than just sins. They're corruptive and destructive habits formed over time. It's not just merely behavioral things or behavioral incidents. It's a habit that forms us and forms our character. Virtues are the things that help us both to live and act well and to be good people. At least that's how Aristotle would have seen it. The key to these is that both gradually internalized produce offspring and are acquired through practice. This is where Jesus says, by their fruits you'll know them. Out of the bad heart comes bad things. Out of the good heart comes good things. It's when these things are internalized inside of us. It isn't just mere actions. It's habits. It's character-forming habits. Sin has this broader scope when we understand what sin is. It includes patterns of sinful behavior, and it's reflective of the reign of sin and death that work within us and around us. But again, the vices are deeply rooted patterns in our behavior, in our character. So the idea of a vice of envy, which is different than jealousy. We can get jealous at times, and we may find ourselves jealous at times, but envy is when we start getting bitter because other people have it better. It's when we constantly see ourselves jockeying to be better than someone else. It's this idea of a comparative worth. Or like when we talk about greed, it's more than just wanting things. It's an obsessive want of things that we would even be willing to compromise virtue or integrity for those things. That's how vices work. So there's a difference between being greedy and living from the vice of greed. There's a difference between envying and living from the vice of envy. It's when our character and our disposition and our way of seeing the world becomes formed in such a way that we just kind of have this as our ongoing thing. When it comes to sloth, I think there's a lot of misunderstanding. I'm going to quote De Young, who said that since the modern industrial era, diligence or industriousness has become a pragmatic virtue aimed at profitability and professional success. When careers replace religion as a source of meaning, worth, and identity, laziness still carries significant weight. Our society measures personal worth in terms of productivity, efficiency, and a maximization of our potential, so we'd better get busy or we'll be good for nothing. Because that's how we see the world, because we see so much about success being about busyness or activity or productivity. When I was in sales, one of my jobs was to enter into a business and help them figure out how to streamline certain processes so that they could become more productive, right? Productivity is a goal. It's an aim. You can get certifications in productivity. And what ends up happening is anytime we see someone who is unproductive, we call them lazy, and we equate laziness with slothfulness. And so then we take the sloth, the creature who moves very slow, albeit very cute, but who moves very slow, and we say that's what it means to be slothful. To be slothful is to be lazy. That is not how the early church nor the Christian tradition understood slothfulness. It wasn't merely about being lazy. It was actually deeper than that. Matter of fact, Friedrich Buechner said this. He said, sloth is not to be confused with laziness. Lazy people who sit around and watch the grass grow may be people at peace. Their sun-drenched bumblebee dreaming may be the prelude to action, or itself an act well worth the acting. Slothful people, on the other hand, may be very busy people. They are people who go through the motions, who fly on automatic pilot. Like somebody with a bad head cold, they have mostly lost their sense of taste and smell. They know something's wrong with them, but not wrong enough to want to do something about it. Other people come and go, but through glazed eyes, they hardly notice them. They are letting things run their course. They are getting through their lives. The reality of the early church and the understanding of slothfulness. Slothfulness is living our lives on autopilot in such a way that we are no longer at wonder. But that is even still a little too complex a definition. So I'll continue to try to boil this down. But to boil it down, I want to start with one very simple reminder. The aim of the Christian life, of all things that we are to do, of all the things to, quote, do, is to understand that we are first loved. And to understand that we are first loved, we understand then that our thing to do above all things, is to love. Jesus has this encounter. You know the story. Matthew 22, verse 36. Teacher, which command in the law is the greatest? He said to him, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, and with all your mind. This is the greatest and most important commandment. The second is like it, that you love your neighbor as yourself. All the law and the prophets depend on these two things. The primal vocation of every Christian is to remember that our entire life is bound up in the idea that we're to be in a relationship of love with God, a relationship of love with God. And that relationship of love with God should compel us to be in a relationship of love with humanity. Now, obviously, we've got all sorts of wonky definitions of love, which is why I call this thing disordered loves. We can love too much, we can love too little, and we can love the wrong things. Slothfulness is ultimately about loving too little. It's about loving too little. The opposite of slothfulness is not diligence, then. Not in the way we often think of it. We think of diligence as persistency in keeping up. Slothfulness is definitely opposed to diligence. That strong sense of responsibility and dedication to hard work and completion of one's duties. But to say that it's diligence within our own English vocabulary is to miss the word diligere, which is the Latin word for diligence, which is the root word for diligence, which means to esteem or to love. See, to be diligent in something isn't to just not quit. To be diligent in something is to see it as so highly valued, so highly esteemed, that one is compelled out of that feeling of esteem for that thing for which I am serving or working toward. Here's a simple definition of sloth. Sloth is laziness about love. It's about being lazy in love. It's not about just being lazy and not wanting to work. It's about not loving the people that I'm supposed to care enough for to want to work. It's different than just being lazy. See, to be loved is to receive the demands that come from love. When Ian was born, that love that I felt grow inside of my heart created demands of me now. My responsibility. Last night, we had to take Sam, our puppy, to the puppy hospital for the first time. Now, in South Georgia, when a dog gets hurt, you don't go to a veterinary clinic. I just want to make that clear. But I've never been an adult and had a puppy before. And I confess, little fella drives me nuts. But dude, I love that little four-legged creature. It's a strange phenomenon inside of me. I used to make fun of all you peppy puppy people. Like now it's like, oh, I love the puppy. Like it was out of question. I found out where a 24-hour clinic was and called him. And I like, our puppy, you know, something's going on. And he said, well, bring him. And I said, okay. I said, how much is it? We'll tell you when you get here. I was like, I don't care. I'll go. And I got there. I was breaking the law. Saw an officer hoping it was Randy. Thankfully, they missed me, so I just kept going. And I'm petting the puppy, swerving in the road. Seriously. Like, I was on Facebook petting the puppy and driving. I'm just kidding. I was just driving and like in the road, and I'm swerving, and I'm like, it's going to be okay. And Sam's just like chilling. Shivering a little and in pain, and I'm getting there, and I get there, and I'm like, dude, like, you know, this is what has to happen. And he goes in, and they don't let me go back there with him. I'm like, I got to go back there with my puppy. This is Sam. And she tells me how cute he is, and I'm like, I know. Will you see if my dog's okay? And they don't let me go back there, and then all of a sudden, they call me back there, and the doctor comes to me, and thankfully, it wasn't like, Mr. Ligon, we have bad news. It was just, hey, we think he might have hyperextended his toe or broke his toe. I'm like, is that all? Well, would you like us to do x-rays? Well, should we do x-rays? Like, this was the exchange. And then the doctor looked at me and said, is this your first animal? I said, yes. I have a child. It's not the same. But as we were like walking through this at home, I thought to myself, like, when we took this puppy on, like, there's a demand now, right? Like, there's an entrustment to this. There's a responsibility to this very alive, living creature that's been entrusted to me. And it's just, I know it's trite, but my point is that there's demands of love. Slothfulness is the kind of person that resists the demands of love. It's the one who wants to have love their way. I want love on my own terms. That, theologically speaking, is slothfulness. The virtue counteracts slothfulness is compelled by the notion that to simply be in a relationship of love is to then receive the demands that that love requires, rather than just want to have it my way or making it a matter of convenience. That's why the Proverbs, the writer of Proverbs says in 13:4, the slothful craves yet has nothing, but the diligent, the one who loves with esteem, is fully satisfied. So to understand that to be slothful is to resist the demands of love is to understand that the love of God and the love of God given is a love that with it, though freely given, though by grace and grace alone, is the kind of love that is meant to transform and to liberate. It is the kind of love that is meant to invite us, to compel us, to summon us into loving. Just as much as God's grace is to make us more gracious, God's love is to make us more loving. If you meet an unloving Christian, then what you have met is a Christian who does not know love. Which is why John says it very bluntly. 1 John 3, verse 1. Look at how great a love the Father has given us that we should be called God's children, and we are. The reason the world does not know us is that it did not know Him. We just sit on that for a while, right? Dear friends, we're God's children now. And what we will be has not yet been revealed. We know that when He appears, we will be like Him, because we'll see Him as He is. Listen to this, though. This hope makes us, compels us to live holy lives as He is holy. In other words, this kind of love demands of us to then love. This kind of love is not to meant just as leave us alone. It's not sentimentality. It's not God loves me because I sang a really, really warm and fuzzy praise song. This is that God loves me, the God of heaven and earth, the maker of heaven and earth and of all things, wants to make His home with me, with you. He wants to welcome us into His love, and intertwine our life with His life. And as we live in that love and learn to love as Jesus loved and to walk as Jesus walked, we are liberated. We are transformed. We're no longer then subject to the approval of others. We realize we're no longer subject to our circumstance. We realize in that love that our identity is set and our worth is secure, that we are no longer subject to the ebb and flow of our feelings and emotions because we see Jesus. And we know that when we were displaced, the love of God revealed to us, and Jesus reminds us that we have a home with Him because we're His children. When we feel unwanted, the love of God revealed to us, and Jesus reminds us that we're always wanted by God and we're His children. When we feel vulnerable, the love of God reveals to us in Jesus that we are valued by God and we are His children. When we are hurt, the love of God revealed to us, and Jesus reminds us that we're always held by God. We are His children. When we're sick, the love of God revealed to us, and Jesus reminds us that we're always supported by God because we're His children. When we're unfaithful, the love of God revealed to us, and Jesus reminds us that He is still faithful in the midst of our unfaithfulness. When we get that, you don't stay the same. And if you stay the same, then you don't get that. And that is a symptom that maybe the vice in my life to learn to submit and overcome is slothfulness. Because maybe I've just grown lazy in love. When we are at our worst, our most unloving selves, and we see God as the God of love, John said God is love. Before God is anything else, He's love. And we remember that. That even in our worst and in our most unloving selves, we remember then that there's nothing in my life that God can't redeem. Even if it's an act performed in willful stupidity or an astounding ignorance, there's nothing God is incapable of redeeming and somehow mysteriously turning into good. And it's because no one's out of the reach of God's love. No one. No one's beyond His reach. There's no span of time or distance as far as the east is from the west. God's love meets us there. I think that's why He came to us in incarnation. I think that's why He came to us with skin. I think that's why He put on brown skin in the Palestinian world and showed us in His life that He is the banquet hosting, table setting, lover of the poor, the lame, the blind, the maimed, the foreigner, the religious, the ridiculous, the righteous, the wretched. He is the lover of humanity. There is no length God will not travel. Show us what it means to be known by the God of heaven and earth. And you and your individual self and all of whoever it is you are is not lost on Him. And He welcomes you. No one is turned away from God. No one is excluded. From the first to the last, all are welcomed. And He invites us to trust Him. To give Him thanks, to take a seat at His table, to enter into His presence. And it's there that healing happens. But it doesn't if we resist the demands that that kind of beautiful love requires. See, because to be loved by God requires a response if that love is to be experienced. Otherwise, there's no response, then it's just words of sentimentality. But if there is a response, then it changes things. And I think John would want us to know that this kind of love, when he says, and we are, that then it requires something of us. Listen to the rest of the text. Little children, let no one deceive you. The one who does what is right or just is righteous, just as he's righteous. The one who commits sin is, John gets real. He gets like old school tent revival, right? The one who commits sin is of the devil. For the devil has sinned from the beginning. The Son of God was revealed to this purpose. Read this with me. To destroy the devil's works, the reign of sin and death, to destroy the works. Just don't think that sin here is just behavioral problems, all right? That's not what this is talking about. This is the vice thing. This is the captivity of the vice, right? The one who doesn't give a flip, right? Verse 9, everyone who has been born of God does not sin. Then what that means is that we still make bad choices. We still make godless decisions. We still talk about our neighbors incorrectly or inappropriately. I've seen it on Twitter, right? Like we still say things ugly about people. We still call names and labels and all that kind of stuff. We still do that. What this is saying is the one who's born of God isn't going to practice this. The one who's born of God sees this, turns from it, and submits back to the demands of love, which is to love. Which is why Jesus said, love God, love neighbor. Everything hangs on that. Right? And so he says, everyone who's been born of God does not sin because a seed remains in him. He is not able to sin because he's been born of God. This is how God's children and the devil's children are made evident. What do you mean, John? Well, this is what I mean. Whoever does not do what is right is not of God, especially the one who does not, say it with me, love his brother. Woo. Like that John's leveling it out. He means what he means. If you say you love God and you don't love your brother, you're not born of God. You need to check your birth certificate. For this is the message you have heard from the beginning. We should love one another. Unlike Cain, who was of the evil one and murdered his brother. Why did he murder him? Because his works were evil and his brothers were righteous. Do not be surprised, brothers, if the world hates you. We know that we have passed from death to life because we love our brothers. Our evidence of our love is in our love for others. The one who does not love remains in what? Death. But everyone who hates his brother is a murderer. And you know that no murderer has eternal life residing in him. This is how we've come to know love, that he laid down his life for us. We should also lay down our lives for our brothers. If anyone has this world's goods and sees his brother in need but closes his eyes to his need, how can God's love be residing in him? This is John's way of saying that if you want to know the fullness of the love of God, the evidence of knowing the fullness of the love of God is how one loves another. John is not saying if you want to know God's love, go love people. John is saying you love people if you know God's love. That's the evidence. What's the thing that works against it? That disposition deep down inside of my soul called slothfulness that wants me to resist the demands of love. The slothful person wants loving God to be easy while avoiding and neglecting love's daily demands. The slothful person just wants feel-good songs and easygoing sermons that let me off the hook and make me feel good about myself and doesn't require anything of me when I leave. The slothful person says, I want to be in relationship with God, but I'm unwilling to be transformed by his love. The slothful person says, I want the comfort and security of being loved by God, but I don't want to have to give back, to sacrifice anything, to take responsibility or invest myself in the relationship over the long haul. But that is not love. See, Paul would say in Ephesians 4, verse 7, therefore, I say this and testify in the Lord that you should no longer walk as the Gentiles walked in the futility of their thoughts. They're darkened in their understanding, excluded from the life of God because of their ignorance that is in them and because of the hardness of their hearts. They become callous and gave themselves over to promiscuity for every practice, for the practice of every kind of impurity with a desire for more and more. Greed comes into this now, right? But that is not how you learned about, that's not what you learned about, that's not how you learned about the Messiah. That's not what he did. Assuming you heard about him and you were taught by him, I like Paul's sort of snarkiness sometimes. Like he's like, that's not how you learned about Jesus. I mean, assuming you actually learned about Jesus. Because the truth is in Jesus. You took off your former way of life. The old self that is corrupted by deceitful desires. You are being renewed. Say being renewed. Say being. We're human beings. We're not human doings. This begins with realizing and remembering and settling in and sitting in the reality that in Jesus you are loved. Like all of your mess, all of my mess, all the junk that we hide, all the things we feel inside, we are loved. You are loved just as you are. Like the holy God who should smite all of us, right? Like smite. I wanted to say that. I've been wanting to say that for a while. King Jimmy used that language. That's a good word, smite. We wanted to smite. We want to smite. We should all just be like destined. We're all doomed, right? Like it should be Chicken Little up in here, right? Like that's the sky should be falling. This is our life. This is where we should be. God is holy. I am not. He doesn't think what I think. He doesn't feel what I feel. He is beautifully, wonderfully perfect. And despite the fact that he says that I'm fearfully and wonderfully made, I act the opposite of that. Why would God love me? And the answer to that is Jesus. Jesus shows that he does. He just does. Well, I don't get it. Well, that's why he's holy. His love is completely utter than anything we could ever fathom because we don't love on those terms. When that takes root, something happens. Verse 23, you're being renewed in the spirit of your minds. You put on the new self, the one created according to God's likeness in righteousness and purity of truth. See, in one sense, it's true that slothful people want the easy life. They find detachment from the old sinful nature too difficult or too painful. They have loyalties and allegiances they don't want to negotiate, you know? And they find it too burdensome, so they neglect to perform the actions that would maintain and deepen relationships of love, especially when it comes to God and others, especially if the other is hard to love. And so they harden their hearts toward any change that requires sacrifice. They harden their heart toward any change that requires surrender. Wanting to love is about easily and comfortably loving, preferring the sentiment of pop songs, Nicholas Sparks books, and Hollywood romances. And it feels wonderful for a little while. But these feelings are just momentary highs, and they can't sustain a relationship. They come cheap, but they don't last. They talk about forever, not remembering that forever has to be sustained by commitments that require daily decisions to keep on loving even when it's hard. Because love does what is right, not what is easy. And even if it doesn't yield a big emotional payoff, sloth is the vice of those who want the security of having God's love without the real sacrifice and ongoing struggle of learning what it means to be made new. So I want to give you three quick symptoms of slothfulness that we all can think about. One symptom of slothfulness is a desperate escapism. It's running from the responsibility of love. It's not showing up because it's too hard, right? It's avoidance. It's constantly looking for a new place to go in an attempt to change my environment, which is just my stimuli, without having my own heart changed or changing my own heart. That's slothfulness. It's a symptom of slothfulness. Another symptom of slothfulness is something that the philosophers call despairing resignation. Our word for that is apathy. This is the position we take when we can't escape. We just turn apathetic. We're awakened to the predicament, and we tend to sink into hopelessness or despair and begin feeling smothered or trapped, and we just become apathetic. Reality becomes oppressive and hard to bear, and our coping strategies just to check out. And we become indifferent. That's why indifference is a sin in the Bible. It just is. And then out of this, we eventually just grow easily bored. But another one that I have to keep in mind in my own life, because I think slothfulness is something I have to keep in mind for me, is the notion of false rest. It's about being there, but not being there at all. It's about being there but not really being present. I have to watch this. This is about busyness without stable, rooted commitment. Because if I'm not busy, I've got to stay put. I've got to deal. And it's just too hard to deal. So I'll just keep my hands busy instead, which is another form of escapism, and you see how this goes. But the Spirit of God inside of you and me is calling us to something deeper. Jesus has invited us into a different kind of way. And so here's the thing. All right, here's the antidote to sloth. You ready? Stability of place. The antidote to sloth is rootedness. The antidote to sloth is staying put. The antidote to sloth is staying present, staying put, not leaving when it gets hard and pressing in, not resting back and not checking out on the sacrifices, not checking out on the responses, not checking out on the fight, not checking out on pushing through. This is in the Capital Vice tradition, so this isn't Fred making this up. This is about 1,800 years old of philosophy and theology behind me here. So this isn't me just bringing something up. So however this counteracts whatever decisions you're making in your life, what you can trust and rest in is that slothfulness can always be uprooted. What it requires is a choice. A choice to press in. And what we need in order to make that choice is the strength of the Spirit of God to do it. And guess what? God has given us all that. The question is, will we tap into it? I mean, look, we have an outlet here, right? Like, this outlet has power going to it. If you walk around with something that needs to be plugged in and we choose not to plug it in, that's a choice we made. But if we just plug it in, the power's there. You don't have to do anything but plug it in and turn it on. The power comes through. The choice to plug it in is the key. That's the difference maker, is the choice to plug it in. It's just a choice. Now, if you're sitting back there, you got to walk all the way up here and you got to climb up this, you know, what is this, a 6-inch step? Hello, that can be tricky. Or like you got to work around all this. You got to get there from here. But it's a choice. The power's there. The power's there. The power's here. But it's been 3 years. Yeah. It's been 10 years. I have no answers for that. It's been 15 years. I have no answers for that. Here's the answer I do have. When Christians gather every week and take the bread and the wine, we remember that to God, 1,000 years is like a day and a day is like 1,000 years. And so in the middle of the waiting and the pressing on and the staying put and the pressing in and the fighting through, because I want to tell you something. Don't mistake staying present for apathy and resignation. It's not resignation. It's not resigning yourself to stay there because it's easier. Sometimes the right thing to do is to move on. To stay could be the apathetic thing to do. To escape the hard work of pressing in. At the end of the day, it's real easy for me. It's got to look like Jesus. When I was a part of a church before I came here, I struggled whether or not I should stay. But it became real easy for me because there was nothing a part of what I was experiencing that really looked like the Jesus I read about in Scripture. The values and the commitments of that community of faith just didn't look like the Jesus that I felt that I needed to follow. I could have stayed there and made good money. I could have stayed there and had a good situation. We had just moved our family halfway across country and we had a baby. It just made sense to stay. There was nothing about Jesus that compelled me to stay. There was everything about Jesus that compelled us to go. So don't get caught up in thinking that it's about going or staying. That's an oversimplification of what the antidote to slothfulness is. What it's about is about faithfully following Jesus and not justifying my decisions. Just because I didn't want to press into the hard thing of love. And I've seen enough of that and done enough of that to know what that looks like. And I think the rest of us do too. So Augustine, he said, "You have made us for yourself and our hearts are restless until they can find rest in you." The restlessness of our hearts will always be there until we finally find the rest we have in Christ. Question I have to ask is, what do I choose? And if every week you gather and we gather and we gather together, we choose the bread and the wine, then we choose love. But when we leave this table, we still choose love. And love's got to look like something. And it's not laziness about love. It's not resisting the demands of love. It is receiving the demands of love and trusting God with the consequences. Knowing that the power is within us if we just make the choice to plug in.